5. Just want to take the opportunity to welcome everybody, both who are present here and those who are present here on Zoom. It's good to have everyone back. Just a friendly reminder that Learning in the Shul this week has been graciously sponsored by our dear friends Dr. and Dr. Wenger in the memory of Sarah Bas Mendel. And this year, this evening in particular, given the fact that we have just completed the shloshim for my father, Hareini Kaparas Mishkavo, so I've also asked and received permission from the Wengers to include the learning that we'll do tonight, really mostly a historical talk with a nice, exciting learning twist in memory of my father, Arav Hillel ben Meir Yechiel Mechel. In many ways, the back and forth between the interplay between history and modern society and the interplay would have probably excited him very much, he and my mother. As for those of you who've already received my word before Shabbos, have probably seen and heard, and those who didn't, you'll understand I am a product, like my siblings, of my parents. Tonight we're going to continue our second in the unit, Jewish Responses to Tragedy, as Brian S. has doubled and nicknamed it, It Ain't Just Tehillim. And we're calling this the Ukraine edition. So we've looked at some of the tragedies of the past that have taken over the Jewish community in Europe, but particularly, believe it or not, starting somewhere around the Ukrainian area. And we've identified some of the Jewish responses that have come out from Ukraine. So last week in our introductory class, we began our discussion of the historical event of Tachvatat, the Khmelnytsky uprising, as it's called in Ukraine, or as we call it, the Khmelnytsky massacres of 1648-1649. And we noted that one of the earliest Jewish responses, and perhaps one of the healthier responses, was to turn to scholarship. And again, part of it was because there was a need to have scholarship, because there were so many questions of the day. And last week we spent a lot of time just discussing the concepts of the really old-fashioned aguna, the classic aguna, and how people have dealt with it in the past. And this evening I'm going to look at and in dealing with that response, what we discovered was the Jewish community in Europe at large, but really specifically in the Ukrainian areas, really learned to develop and deal with tragedy by using focused scholarship as a response, sort of to anchor the people. I left you with a thought last time. What happens when somebody doesn't feel that he or she can sort of latch onto scholarship in order to find an anchor in the middle of a tragedy? And I mentioned to you that the other three units that we're going to have in this series are all going to focus on broader-based than just the rabbis, broader-based than just the rabbinical world. So some of them will be impressive to us. And after Purim, we'll talk about the back and forth between Hasidus as a whole, between Hasidus and Chabad, all of which the controversies came up in Ukraine, right? And then the week after that, we will sum up when we start talking about the role of Chibat Zion, the idea of religious, the idea of Zionism as a whole, and then specifically the marriage between Zionism and religious Zionism, and that too, the origins of Zionism, believe it or not, find themselves not with Herzl, but actually in the Ukraine. So those are going to be our upcoming units, and we're going to have some time to talk about some of the major players and how exactly the Ukrainian response, what were they responding to, and how did it shape modern times. And those will take place on the two Thursday nights after Purim. Next Thursday night, there'll be no class. But let's backtrack to where we're going to be tonight, because sometimes people get stuck. They have this incredible intensity, and they really can't make sense out of tragedies that they just went through. And they look to find a way to explain it, things that are unexplainable. And somebody can step onto the world stage at that point and corrupt that period in time. So in 1648, 1649, actually in the period leading up to 1648, 1649, there was a very strong messianic fervor that gripped the Jewish people as a whole. And this was based on computations, based on interpretations of the Zohar, and particularly in the mindset of European Jewry, with the understanding that the year of 1648 was going to be a year of redemption. It was going to be an opportunity for Geula. And so, of course, in 1648, there was a 22-year-old gentleman who rose in an area of Turkey known as Smyrna, and his name was Shabtai. And he decided that he was indeed going and declared himself to be the Messiah. And in order to prove this claim, he started to do a lot of weird stuff. He began to start using the name of God in only the Shema HaMeforash, the special name of God that only was used in the Beis HaMikdash and only by the Kohen Gadol in the Beis HaMikdash. And so anybody who heard that and saw that, interpreted it as highly symbolic. He used to say he was able to fly, but he said he couldn't do so in public because you had to be at a certain level to be able to witness him flying. So, that's why he didn't do things. He claimed to have regular visions of God. And he was still young, and people just decided he wasn't messianic. They thought he was nuts. And so his influence didn't really carry forward. But around 1651, or according to others, 1654, so we're still dealing with a time that paralleled what we talked about last week, when we were discussing how the Khmelnytsky uprising was a two-year deal, but the wars that subsequently came about in that area of Europe were still pretty strong until the mid-1650s. And the rabbis turned around in 1651 in Turkey, and they said, Shabtai Tzvi, you're out of here. And they banished him from Smyrna. And we don't know where exactly he went to, but by 1658, he was in Constantinople, and he met Avram Yechini. Who was Avram Yechini? Avram Yechini was a disciple of Rabbi Yosef de Trani. And Avram Yechini said, well, I think that he is, I was in a cave for 40 years. I wondered what time was going, the period of Nisim, the period of miracles of Messianic era are going to come. And I heard a voice that in that cave that said to me that in the year 1626, there was going to be a child that was going to be born to a person named Mordechai Tzvi, and his name will be Shabtai, and he's going to be able to become the Mashiach. He's going to sit on Hashem, on the throne of the Jewish people. So there we had a certain support by a rabbinic student. Right? He was a student of Rav Isaac de Trani. He was the student of the Mabit, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee him a tremendous following to begin with. Notwithstanding, during the Khmelnytsky massacres in Poland, at the same period in time, there was a Jewish orphan girl whose name was Sarah. And Sarah was about 6 years old during the massacres, and she was discovered by Christians, and she was sent to a convent. And after 10 years of being in the convent, so she's about 16, she ran away from the convent. She said it was through a miracle, and she makes her way to Amsterdam. And some years later, she winds up going to Livorno, and she began to live life as a woman of the night. She was a prostitute. And she also came up with a certain idea in her head that she was supposed to be the bride of Messiah, right? So here we have Shabtai Tzvi declaring himself to be Messiah, and she is going to become the bride of Messiah. Well, when the word about her rumor starts to come up, and it gets to Cairo, where Shabtai Tzvi was sort of hanging around as he was traveling around the Middle East, he says, oh, wow, he had a vision that Taka, because of course, and the Middle East at the time, they were obviously speaking Yiddish. He said, Taka, I had such a vision that there's going to be such a girl and she's going to become my wife. And he said, as Mashiach, his job was supposed to be to marry a woman who wasn't chaste. Why? Because if you know through your Nevi'im, that also happened to the Navi as well. Hosea, HaNavi, was also told to take an Eshes Znunim. And so he says, I'm supposed to do that. And so he decides, here he is, he's going to marry this girl. He goes ahead, and a new element enters the career of Shabtai Tzvi. Right? And what is that? There are now a bunch of followers who see this licentious side of the Sabbatean movement. Now let me just add, just as an aside, when a lot of fun starts to come around a religious figure, people become very drawn because there's potential for a lot of good stuff to happen. And so we're going to see, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on Shabtai Tzvi tonight, we're going to look at one of the later people, because we're going to bring this back to the Ukraine. right? But basically, this element is important for us to highlight, that people were looking for something and they were able to find it and not have to work too hard for it. And not only that, it was fun. And so therefore, people started to get very excited about Shabtai Tzvi. And on Rosh Hashanah 1665, Shabtai Tzvi, assisted by his wife, he declares himself to be Mashiach, and he became the leader of the community, you know, also again assisted by the fact that his wife was known as the life of the party, especially among the guys. So sure enough, he uses this tremendous power that he has to crush any opposition. So there was a Rav in Smyrna, the very place where he had been exiled, Aaron LaPapa, and he says, "You're out of here." And instead, he takes a person who was a little bit more sensitive to him, Rav Chaim ben Benisti, and he decides that he's going to move forward. And so he begins the messianic movement known as Shabtai Tzvi. And in 1606, this didn't exactly excite the leadership in Turkey. They were Islamic. And so instead of just being amused by Shabtai Tzvi, they decided to use Shabtai Tzvi. And so in 1666, Shabtai Tzvi was converted to Islam. And basically, for the most part, the incredible large following that he had drawn was now bereft. We'll try to figure out why that happened. But basically, you're talking about a period in history where there were terrible massacres. There people were looking for, they had these very high hopes that for whatever reason had come up in the Kabbalah. And now their hopes had been dashed. And now they were pretty low. So they put their hope into this fellow claiming to be Shabtai Tzvi, claiming to be Mashiach. And sure enough, what happens? Not a tremendous amount. And the people get smacked down again. Well, you know, there's a rule in baseball. Charlie's waving his finger. He's like, "No way, Jose." There's a rule in baseball. You don't get one strike. You don't get two strikes. What do you get? Three strikes before you're out. Today they announced that the lockout is over in baseball. So I guess it's time to allow the theories to flow forward. Well, after Shabtai Tzvi had been converted, so the Sabbateans were not so ready to toss their belief system into the garbage. Maybe they had the wrong man, but they had the right idea. So they tossed themselves behind a fellow who is identified as Barukya, right? And he continues running the show in Turkey, right, for a number of years. But here's where the fun for tonight is going to start. Because there was another fellow who was born in 1726. His name is Jacob Frank. Now, he was a little bit of a wild child growing up. And his father says, "I can't have you here in the Ukraine growing up as a wild child. You're going to, you don't listen in school. You don't really do too much." So his father scoops him up and brings him with him on a business trip to Turkey, Izmir to be exact. And he says, "Here's what's going to happen. You're going to work here as an apprentice, right, for a certain precious stone cutter, and you're going to become a gemologist, right? You'll work in the diamond business, and all will be good for you." So Jacob Frank, takes the job, and he continues to work for a number of years. And at 26 years old, he gets married. He has two sons, not particularly memorable, but he also has a daughter, Rachel Chava. Hold on to Rachel Chava's name. She will reappear in our history in a couple of moments. In the meantime, here's this kid all by himself, working as an apprentice, walking around in Turkey, both before and after he marries. And he gets very aware of a certain group of very, very spiritual people. And so he gets taken by the Sabbatean element, these former followers of Shabtai Tzvi, who are walking around in the time. And so, and especially this group had spread itself all the way over to Salonika, and Barukia is still running the show, and they're spread pretty far and wide. And he starts hanging out with the crowd. He's pretty impressed by them. He's hanging out with them. Well, Barukia dies. And now they have a new problem. Because it's very hard to have a separatist messianic group if you don't have a messiah to lead the group. And so Jacob Frank says, "I have an idea." he looks in the newspaper and he sees that in human resources, they see there's a job opening for leader of messianic cult. And so Jacob Frank decides he's going to take over. And he declares himself to be the new leader of this messianic group. But you know what the problem is? You can't be a leader if the people don't want to follow you. Right? And Turkey, the people said, who is this crazy European guy over here? They don't accept him. And they start throwing stones at him when he starts to missionize to bring the people together. So Frank says, what do I need all this for? Right? If you're in one area and nobody wants to daven with you in your separatist element, what do? You go to another place and you open up your own congregation. So he says, if you're a messianist, he's going to do it on a grand scale. And so what does he do? He says, why do I have to sit here? I'm going to go back to Europe. And specifically the area of annexed Poland that we described last time, where all the trouble had started, the people's spirits are still broken, right? Including the aforementioned Ukraine, right? And he turns around and decides, I'm going away. And he leaves his wife behind with her family in Izmir, right, in Turkey. But he goes off and goes to sort of see what the story and the lay of the land is in Europe. Well, the Sabbateans in Europe, the people who had been following Shabtai Tzvi but didn't really know about Brukia, remember, there was no Fox News, there was no internet, there was no opportunity in Newsmax to really figure out what's going on where. So they're happy. They're thrilled beyond belief. And so they're looking for something to hold on to after all these unexplained mistakes of 1648, 1649. And they can't believe that they were so wrong about Chabtai Tzvi. And so he shows up on the scene in his big Turkish fez, right? On top of his head with the big pom-pom in the back, right? And he says, I want you to know, I was born 40 years after Shabtai Tzvi dies. And as anyone who studies Kabbalah knows, 40 years is a very significant number. There's only one problem with his claim. He was not born 40 years. He was born a little bit more, closer to 54 years after the death of Shabtai Tzvi. But what's 14 years to somebody who can't get fact-checked, right? There is no, what's the name of the organization? There is no James O'Keefe organization walking around Project Veritas. There's nothing that has to be proven to fact-check the guy. And so therefore, you know, there are a bunch of guys sitting in Poland and Ukraine, etc., and these little shtetlach, and they hear, and he sounds good, and he's walking around in a fez, so he says, I'm really just a Svardi. And that's, he says, that's why I'm calling myself from now on Jacob Frank. Why is he calling himself Frank? Because Frank is the word for Sfaradi. And he starts walking around Europe dressed as a Sephardic Jew. In fact, a Turkish Sephardic Jew. And he claims that all of his weird practices, that everyone's looking at him funny, we don't do that here, right? He says, no, you don't understand. I'm following the practices of the Zohar HaKadosh. And so if you guys want to hang out with me, right, you too can become adherents to the world of Kabbalah. And so sure enough, he draws a faction of people who are dying to find explanation and meaning in their lives, right? It was before Roseanne Barr and Madonna joined up with the Kabbalah Center, so he couldn't actually hire them to do the job. But he was giving his classes as in his own Kabbalah center, right? And he was so good at bringing the people over that they start changing their last names. And so we start finding Jewish last names in Europe becoming Zoharstein and Kabbalstein, right? Short for, you know, people who follow the Zohar, which is one of the major works of Kabbalah, and the Kabbalah itself. Now, on the whole, to people looking in on the outside, what's really going on over here? To the outsider, he looks and acts strange, but they say, he's Sephardic, right? And there's no proof to anything that looks off the charts. And so the people are sort of okay with all of that. But there was a certain writer who was living at this period in time. We're talking about the mid to late 1700s. And he was always very worried about messiness, especially in Europe. And his name is Rav Yaakov Emden. And Rav Yaakov Emden, from whom we get most of the writing of tonight's class in different areas, Rav Yaakov Emden gets a hold of the prayer books that the people who are following Jacob Frank are using, and he looks at the prayers, and he finds that in the prayers themselves that are being prayed in the areas that Jacob Frank is encouraging, they're crossing out Jewish words and they're putting in words of heresy up and down the side. But to the outside, people just frankly don't understand. That was an unintentional pun, Dr. Wenger. They frankly don't understand, right? What's so bad? What's the big deal? Because it's all going on the inside, away from everybody. Well, this is all fine and dandy until 1756. On the 26th of Shvat, 1756, Shabtai Tzvi decides that he's got to have a rally. Going to bring the people together. And so he decides, what's he going to do? He's going to hold a party. Maybe like, I guess in today's times, we'd call it a Fabrengen, right? And he goes to his friend's house, Leib Bar Aaron. Leib Bar Aaron is the fellow who owns the house. He's a strong Frankist. He's a big supporter of Jacob Frank. And in this house, you name it, it was happening at the party. There was drinking, people, to quote the Megillah out of context, Hashisiya Kadas Einones. Everyone was able to drink as much as they wanted at the Fabrengten. And then all of a sudden people start acting in a very inappropriate manner. In fact, even the Rebbetzin of the town, as it is described, had taken the crown of the Sefer Torah, the one that you put on top, you know, the silver crowns, and she's got the crown of the Sefer Torah on top of her head. And she's dancing around in the middle of the room with all these guys, all the Frankists. In fact, the people decide, based on Kabbalistic understanding, with that crown on your head, you're like a mezuzah, they tell her. And you know what we do to a mezuzah? You got it. And so once again, just like Shabtai Tzvi before him, you know, the people inside are kissing her left and right. And the outside people, the community, it's the Rebbetzin, where's the rabbi? And they look around, the rabbi's sitting at the table drinking, and he's nodding his head, and the people in the community are going crazy. So riots start from the outside, and they break into the house to break up all this stuff. And this leads to a massive, massive back and forth within the Jewish community. Accusations start flying around that there's all sorts of weird stuff going on at this party. Not only is the Rebbetzin dancing around and being kissed as a mezuzah, Jacob Frank is accused of having his own daughter, Rachel Chava, there and engaging in inappropriate relations with her in front of everybody else. So the police get called. And there are a number of arrests that are demanded. And, you know, for the first couple of hours, it seemed a little bit tense. But within the first 3 days, somehow, because he is a citizen of Turkey and not of Europe, Jacob Frank flees. He's let out of prison, and he runs away for 3 years. According to some different versions of the history, it might not have been a solid 3 years. He might have been slipping in and out because he's coming to the back road shtetlach. It's not like they had a very good system, right? No one actually built a wall or anything on the borders to make sure that illegal guests couldn't get into the country. But he was able to slip in and out of Europe. And he's slipping in and out, but for the most part, he is primarily back in Turkey. Well, in the meantime, Europe is still sort of reeling over this crazy guy and what's going on over here. In Sanatov, one of the great areas, they decided to start taking testimony as to what exactly was going on with this group that's spreading like wildfire around the areas of the Ukraine and Galicia, which is part of the western part of Ukraine today, right? And it leads the rabbis over there to issue what's known as a cherem, as a ban. And they decided in the ban that the Frankists were guilty of a whole bunch of sins, a tremendous number of averos, including, but not limited to, says Rav Yaakov Emden in his commentary to Masechta Megillah, right? Gilui Arayos, he says, and Avodah Zarah. Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, right, which is also, if I'm not mistaken, in this area, he adds that, you know why all of this was happening? He says, it doesn't require a tremendous amount of esoteric understanding. when people misapply Kabbalistic ideas and resources, all sorts of weird stuff starts to happen. And he says that, this is Rav Tzadok HaKohen looking back over the situation, he says that's what happened with the Frankists. Now hold on to that in your back pocket, because that's going to become a very major issue for us in modern times. But what had happened at that point in time was people couldn't make sense out of what was revealed to them, and so what they had decided to do was to look beyond into areas they didn't understand. And Rav Tzadok HaKohen is telling us that Jacob Frank was able to take advantage of this and use it in order to drag people into the wrong direction. On the 20th of Sivan, 1756. Now remember, the 20th of Sivan was a very significant day on the Jewish calendar, because not only did it commemorate some of the issues during the First Crusades, it was also the day that they chose to commemorate the Khmelnytsky massacres. And so in the town of Brody, which is one of the major areas, you can see it on the map today, it's pretty clear it's called Brod today, but it's right there in the Ukraine, they decided in the middle of the commemoration, everyone was in shul for this commemoration for the Khmelnytsky massacres, and they issue a ban against all Frankists. And in the same ban, they also issued a rule whereby no one in the Orthodox Jewish community is permitted to study Kabbalah before he turns 30. And really, they said, you really, even after you're 40, you shouldn't be studying Kabbalah, unless mile kreso b'shasu poskim, unless the person is really totally exhausted the study of the oral law, of the Gemara, the Talmud, and halachic responses. And the chief rabbi of Lvov, again, in what country? Ukraine. The chief rabbi of Lvov, Rav Chaim Rapoport, who was the major Torah authority of the area, signs this cheirim along with 14 other rabbis of Ukraine. This leads the Frankists to be chased out of their Orthodox Jewish communities. They are being chased out of the Orthodox Jewish community. They're not big enough in number to be able to form their own community. Well, if you're not allowed to be in the Jewish community, and you don't want to switch away from your crazy beliefs, what do you do? And so the Frankists decide that they're going to turn to the Catholic Church for support. But how do you get the Catholic Church involved with the Jews? Like, this is an internal dispute between Jews. Well, the Frankists come up with a new idea, led by Jacob Frank. They said they're going to convert to Christianity, right? They're going to convert to Christianity, and they said that they were going to agree to believe in the Trinity. Well, the archbishop in the area decides, hey, there's a tremendous opportunity over here. And so he says, let's try to sweeten the pot a little bit for the good old-fashioned Catholics. And one of their favorite pastimes in European history was to go after the Talmud, right? If you could destroy the Talmud, you can destroy the heart and soul of what makes the Jewish people unique from, say, other religions, which had, you know, sort of been outgrowths of the Jewish religion. And this leads to what they used to do is have many debates that were stacked against the Jewish community. We know about the most famous debate, I would say, is the debate that took place in the time of the Ramban many, many, many hundreds of years earlier in Barcelona. But not as well known was the debate in Podolia. And this debate took place, Podolia is in western Ukraine. And the archbishop, known as Dombrovsky, works with the Frankists. And he tells them, okay, we'll have this debate. You will debate the authentic Jewish rabbis, and you'll debate the issues of the Talmud. There was a fix. The fix is in on this story. And the Jews had decided they're not going to participate. Why come to a game that you know you're going to lose? Well, the church says, no, you don't understand. This is not a voluntary option for you. You guys have to be coerced into participating. And Dombrovsky says, I'm going to get both of you guys together, because he wants to really see, are the Frankists really Catholics? Are they converting? Or are they really just trying to play a fast one over us, the Catholics? So Dombrovsky sets up the situation whereby the Frankists defeat the Jews in the debate. And then he says, now that you've won, you guys get to choose the punishment for the losers. Do we set up a situation of torture and annihilation and major fine? Or do you get a choice to be entitled to a certain degree of a fine, which of course is payable to the church, of course, and you get to destroy all the volumes of the Talmud? So the Frankists say, well, of course we'd rather go ahead and destroy the volumes of the Talmud. No need to kill people. Maybe they'll come around and become Frankists. And so they start doing so immediately. And where do they decide that they're going to start the game? In a town called Kamenitz. Where is Kamenitz? Right there on the border. So they agree to destroy all Talmud copies in Podolia, right? And the Frankists, they decide that if they're not even sure it's copies of the Talmud, they're going to burn it. So according to some of the testimonies that I've had access to in the last couple of days, they took everything. A pair of tefillin has parshios inside. Those parshios, those parchments, are not Talmudic at all. They are straight from the written law, Torah Shebiksav. They're from the Torah. Well, they are destroying tefillin. You name it, they're destroying it. The archbishop, remember we mentioned him before, Dombrovsky. So the archbishop, he's real proud of himself. Look, he defeated the Jews. He used the Jews to defeat the Jews, right? And he's like really proud of the way he's pulled this fast one off on everybody. So he decides he really is proud, and he's going to go celebrate with himself. And he's going to throw a big party right on top of the pyre that has just destroyed all those volumes of the Talmud. And on his way to the great celebration, he gets very sick. And he orders the wagon be turned around and brought back to his castle, and he goes back to the castle, and he goes back to sleep. All this is recorded by Rav Yaakov Emden in his version of events. Well, we'll see why I'm pointing this out to you in a minute. And then Dombrovsky winds up unconscious for 3 days and three nights. He wakes up after 3 days and three nights, and everyone's staring at him, and he says, why are there ants all over the room? I'm not talking about, you know, the fact that Aunt Sophie and Aunt Sadie were in the room. And the people are looking at him, and they say, there are no ants there. And he screams, he says, those aren't ants. They're all the letters of the alphabet from all the volumes of the Talmud that I just destroyed. He says, we got to do something. We better appease the Jews. I'm telling you. And they all thought he was crazy. Well, he agrees to pay a tremendous, tremendous amount back to the Jewish community to deal with the situation. The Frankists are downstairs. They're praying for, you know, Dombrovsky, thinking, you know, hey, they just won. They owed him one. So they're offering some version of prayer in the process. And he looks at them and he sees what's going on, and he orders that the Frankists who are downstairs be punished rather seriously. And he dies in the process, but not before the Frankists who are ordered to deal with the situation and be punished. So Rabbi Yaakov Emden, when he finishes off telling the story, says it's time, as one of the leading authorities in Europe at the time, although he was not here, he's in Amsterdam, he's in Altoona, right? So he says, he calls for a holiday to celebrate the miracle. And he says, in order to properly celebrate this holiday, I kid you not, I'm quoting, he says, part of the celebration needs to include Mishloach Manos, right? Mishloach Manos, for those who study the Torah, for the Lomdei Torah, it was in their merit that this came about. And Matanos Levionim, sound vaguely familiar, right? And many note that I mentioned to you, this was Rav Yaakov Emden's version of events. There are other people who record a totally different process. They say what happened was that it wasn't him. There was another individual who was walking around at the time. His name was Rabbi Yisrael. He was known as Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem. Or as we'll find out next week, he was otherwise known as the Baal Shem Tov. And so in one of the earlier recordings, so Baal Shem Tov never wrote anything down. But in one of the early recordings of his ideas, it is suggested that it wasn't the Lomdei Torah that saved the life of the Baal Shem Tov, of the Jewish community, but rather it was the tzaddik, the Baal Shem Tov himself. Here we have what I will consider perhaps as a a preview of things soon to come, one of the major disputes we're going to find between the Hasidic movement and the belief in the single tzaddik versus, you know, the traditional Torah system of scholarship in the community and the community's Torah leaders. But I'll get back to that at another point in time. I just want you to see that even in this unit, we're finding that sort of tension coming up. Well, the Frankists lose, as you saw, and they decide that they're going to convert again. And Jacob Frank winds up converting in a ceremony in Poland. And I mentioned that Dombrowski, sort of dies off. There's a tremendous amount written about Dombrowski in church literature, you should just know. He's not really so recognized, it's not hard to understand why. But Vartsalov comes back afterwards, and he decides, okay, Frankists, you all want to convert? We're going to convert en masse. However, you should just know, he suspected that the Frankists themselves were not so into the idea of converting, and they discovered that inside the Frankist sitter, where they said that they were adding in the elements of the Trinity, they did that when they were inspected, but then they came back and discovered that all those references to him were erased. And instead, the Frankists find themselves in an uncomfortable position. What are they going to do? So when in doubt, blame the Jews. So the Frankists now turn against their fellow Jews and institute yet another element that we found to be kind of common in Europe. And what was that? The blood libel. What's a blood libel? A blood libel was an old canard that anti-Semites used to use to suggest that Jews actually used to use Christian blood in their services. And particularly very popular around Pesach time, right? And so they decided that they were going to testify. There are different aspects that are brought down by different Jewish historians, different accounts, noting that Frankists themselves came in and testified. We were there, we saw it in the large shuls, etc. One in particular, they said, look, they say it always at their Pesach Seder, right? There is a siman, a little code word. After we take off for the Makos, we say, Dam Tzardea. Then we mention Rabbi Yehuda, Hayano Tein Bahem Simanim. What did he say? Anyone remember? Ditzach Adash Be'achav. So the Frankist said, you know what that stands for? It stands for the following phrase. Dam Tzrichim Kulanu. We all need blood. Al Derech She'asu Ba'oso Ish. Right? Chachamim B'Yerushalayim. In the same manner that the wise people of Jerusalem did to him, referring, of course, to Jesus. All right, so they, Frankists are saying, this is what's going on here. Right? Well, eventually the Frankists, after a tremendous amount of fear that gripped the European community, and they turned to Rav Yaakov Emden to get him to get involved at higher levels in the Vatican, and he was somewhat successful, and then others turned around and they caught the Frankists in some of their lies. And so whatever it was, the majority of people who had identified themselves as Frankists wound up in jail, only later to wind up being eventually freed. We were eventually freed from Jacob Frank when he dropped dead at 65. Not a tremendously positive influence, both in the Jewish community, but even in the Christian community, the Catholics also really didn't trust the Frankists. And so this becomes one of those elements where we have to stop and scratch our heads. Why is this significant? Why did the Jews get so excited about Frank? And of course, about Shabtai Tzvi as well. So I think what the rabbis of the time had decided was the Jews were looking for something. And what was it that they were looking for? Some sense of meaning for things that were too far away from them. What? And hope, yes. And they decided to put it into sacred texts that they never would understand. Which leads to a certain discussion that I think is worth it to have in the final couple of minutes of the class as to whether one should have limitations in the study of Kabbalah. Some people wanted to argue that, you know, we have certain issues in the mystical texts that if we interpret them literally, we're going to wind up with very backwards understandings. There are discussions in halacha what to do when Kabbalah disagrees with normative halacha. And we never, ever follow the opinion of the Kabbalah. The Shach, we mentioned the Shach last week, there's a famous comment of the Shach who says that when we have differences of opinion between Nigla and Nistar, between that which we normatively follow in halacha and that which is more Kabbalistic, we do not follow the position of the Kabbalah. There's a normative system of Judaism, and that's the way we're supposed to proceed. Others argue against the tensions between normative halacha led to too many deliberations, and it causes a lot of trouble. Some people were very upset with the way God is perceived in Kabbalistic writings. Sometimes the writing is a little bit overly flowery and expressive, almost hypersexualized. Well, if you take it at face value, you're going to wind up lost. In fact, there's a Jewish encyclopedia called Otzar Yisrael. It was written by a fellow named Yehuda David Eisenstein. He lived between 1854 and 1956. And he discusses something called Adam Kadmon, primordial man, which is a Kabbalistic term that describes the first spiritual world that existed perhaps even before the physical world, and included an image of a man that was created with something called the Ten Sefirot. These are Kabbalistic ideas and concepts. Well, Rav Kook, the famous chief rabbi of the state of Israel, he writes a letter to the author of Otzar Yisrael, and he says, how could you put an image in the book? He says, even drawing an image of a human being could lead to great danger to people who believe in Judaism if that image is being written in the style of Kabbalah. The Rivash, going back all the way pre the Ukrainian episode, living between 1326 and 1408, mentions that he gets very puzzled by some of the practices of davening that are done by Kabbalists. The kavanos, he says, are very strange. The Noda B'Yehuda has a tshuva where he saw that a person, we have a rule called Nikitas Chefetz, when a person has to take a vow, he has to hold something valuable. And the general custom was always, if you wanted to make somebody really swear, make him hold the most valuable thing we have, which is the Torah. I swear on the Torah. Well, Rabbi Elazar Feklis, who was in Prague, who was a student of the Noda B'Yehuda, was asked, can you use a copy of the Zohar HaKadosh? And Feklis says, I don't understand. Who says there's any religious authority of the Zohar HaKadosh? Right? Who wrote the Zohar HaKadosh? And he says, by the way, since the Zohar HaKadosh has become more popularized, this right, this Kabbalistic work, many people have been misled because of its difficult practices. In fact, Feklis writes that look at Shabtai Tzvi, look at Jacob Frank, look at how they destroyed our people, our faith, and used the Zohar HaKadosh to explain it. And so therefore he says, it's probably not the greatest idea to attribute the same value to it. When the issue was brought up in more modern times, Rav Ovadia Yosef was asked about Kabbalah centers. And he said, on the one hand, there are many sources that support the belief that these teachings must be in the private domain. He rules and says that it should really only be involved with those who are Malei Kresam B'Shasu Poskim. It should only be, the Kabbalah is not something that should be studied on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles, but rather should be studied in among the righteous and the pious. And since it's that's the case, it's almost impossible for a person to follow through and understand it, understand halacha, if one is studying Kabbalah, unless you have a really deep understanding of the halacha. That said, the Munkach Rebbe, right, the Rav Chaim Eliezer Shapira, who is quotes opinions that says just the opposite. If we believe we're living in the period of time known as Ikva de Mashicha, that we're living in the era of the coming of Mashiach, then anyone who wants to study Kabbalah should be allowed to study Kabbalah. Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook was a very big advocate of studying Kabbalah. He would quote Zohar left and right. And according to Rav Cook, one of the reasons for the crisis of faith in the modern time is the study of Agada and the philosophical side of Judaism and the fact that it's been tossed aside. So he says, Talmidei Chachamim have to study Jewish philosophy and Machshava and Kabbalah as well. The stringencies of the past need to be brought forward. So here we have two sides of the modern day application having grown out of this period in history. If we're going, and Messianism has been used by some as an argument in favor of the continued study of Kabbalah, but with certain boundaries to it. A person needs to be able to understand who is studying, who the teacher is, what you're studying, what the student understands. And if not, all sorts of strange ideas can come forth. And so again, if response level number one to tragedy was increased scholarship, and we saw that as tremendously positive, then in summation, response number two from Ukraine, Kabbalists and Messianists, we have to say to ourselves, Kabbalah, be very careful. Messianism, be very fearful. And with God's help, we're going to turn around in 2 weeks' time, and we're going to watch this sort of in a semi-normative way come into a heavy clash as we start to figure out what exactly the world of Hasidus was all about. Who were the Hasidim originally? What were their original beliefs? And what were the beliefs of those who opposed them? And, of course, to figure out where things sit today. So I wish you all a wonderful Shabbos, a terrific Shabbos Zachor, and with God's help, a Freilich and Purim, and the Yeshuos of the past, the Geulos of the past, may they be paled in comparison to the one that we should quickly merit to experience today, but only at the hands of the rightful people who are there to lead us in the process. Everyone have a great Shabbos.